want to see our American citizens brought home. We have been asking that, we've been calling on that, the North Korean government, for that for quite some time.
U.S. officials say that North Korea could release detained Americans soon. It's Friday, May 4th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Remember, you're part of the program. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, a top U.S. delegation is in China for trade talks. South Asia is home to nearly 2 billion people. How will climate change affect them? And a Chinese-owned horse is favored in the Kentucky Derby. That's all on VOA Asia. Thanks for being with us on this Friday morning. U.S. officials have indicated that North Korea could soon release three detained Americans. U.S. President Donald Trump hinted at an imminent release in a tweet earlier this week, saying that, as everybody is aware, the past administration has long been asking for three hostages to be released from a North Korean labor camp, but to no avail. Stay tuned, he wrote. However, two of those Korean Americans were taken captive when Mr. Trump was president. Three Korean Americans are currently imprisoned in North Korea. Tony Kim and Kim Hak-song were teaching at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. They were separately detained in 2017 and accused of participating in anti-state activities and trying to overthrow the government. The third detainee, Kim Dong-chul, was arrested in Northern Korea in October of 2015. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison with hard labor in 2016 after being convicted of espionage. Talk of their release comes before a proposed summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. At the White House Thursday, spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said releasing the three men would be a sign of goodwill from North Korea.
We can't confirm the validity of any of the reports currently out about their release, but we certainly would see this as a sign of goodwill if North Korea were to release the three Americans ahead of discussions between President Trump and Kim Jong-un.
At the State Department Thursday, spokeswoman Heather Nauert echoed Sanders, saying that she cannot confirm the reports, but that North Korea releasing the three men would be a charitable gesture ahead of the summit.
We certainly think it would be a very good sign if North Korea, and a wonderful gesture of goodwill, if North Korea were to release our three Americans who've been detained there.
Ken Gauss is the director of the International Affairs Group at the nonprofit research and analysis organization CNA. He told VOA that releasing the three men might be a gesture of goodwill, but probably will not happen before Trump and Kim meet.
I think one of the sweeteners that the North Koreans have put on the table and probably told the United States and through back channels is that they'd be willing to release the three persons who have been held in detention or, I guess, put in a labor camp. Recent news is that they have been moved to a hotel in Pyongyang. I suspect that the idea would be to turn them over during the summit as an act of goodwill on North Korea's part.
Gauss added that North Korea is not likely to give major concessions on its nuclear program without getting some major concessions in return.
I mean, North Korea is not about to give up their program without having something major in return. And I don't think that the United States has enough goodwill built up with North Korea in order for North Korea to believe any promises the United States makes about not attacking them or anything like that. So they're still obviously concerned about regime change. And I think that it will probably ultimately take some sort of regional security agreement in which North Korea's equities and survival of the Kim family system is guaranteed before they would even contemplate giving up the entire program.
Ken Gauss said if the summit occurs as planned, he believes the United States and North Korea must have some sort of broad agreement on what the parameters of negotiations are. He said Pyongyang might be willing to give up some portions of its nuclear program, but that the issue will probably continue after the summit. We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. China says North Korea's Kim is committed to denuclearization. South Korea is developing economic projects for North Korea. Afghan president launches controversial national ID card. In Indonesia, interfaith marriage is legal, but with many obstacles. And Germany says Liu Xiaobo's widow is welcome at any time. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. I'm David Byrd in Washington. A high-level U.S. trade delegation has begun talks with Chinese officials in Beijing as Washington tries to address deep concerns about China's economic policies. The meeting is seen by some as a positive step as the two sides attempt to avoid the possible outbreak of a trade war. Analysts say it is not likely their differences will be resolved during the two-day meetings, but a decision to keep talking would be welcome progress. Raymond Young is a senior economist for Greater China at the Australia and New Zealand Banking Group. He says if the two sides can at least agree to keep talking with each other, that would be big progress.
Well, I think it's too demanding to if we expect both sides can come up with an agreement or an announcement or sign a deal. I think, of course, it's very demanding. But if they are able to promise that they're willing to sit down and continue the dialogues and try to resolve the difference, at least that can signal that the relationship of the two governments kind of a warm-up.
Differences over trade policy and market access have been a persistent concern for the United States and other foreign investors in China. In recent weeks, the debate has become even more heated, with President Trump threatening to slap a long $50 billion list of tariffs on Chinese goods to punish Beijing. He said that is for unfair trade practices, forced technology transfer, intellectual property rights, and state subsidies for technology development. Beijing has denied Washington's accusations and insists its market is opening. The Chinese government has also responded with threats of its own, saying that if the United States presses ahead with tariffs, it will respond in kind. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is leading the U.S. delegation and is meeting with a group of Chinese officials led by Chinese Vice Premier Liu He, a close aide to China's President Xi Jinping. In 2015, the Chinese government unveiled a key policy plan called Made in China 2025, which aims to make China dominant in 10 major next-generation industries, including robotics, electric cars, artificial intelligence, biotech, and aerospace. An investigation by the Trump administration into China's unfair trade practices mentions that policy more than 100 times. The policy clearly sets goals for domestic industries to dominate foreign players in the Chinese market and worldwide. Beijing has characterized President Trump's threats to tax exports and attack the government's policies as an attempt to contain China and force the Chinese market to become more open, something that officials and state media have repeatedly stressed will never happen. Christopher Balding is a professor at Peking University's HSBC Business School. He says bridging such a huge gap during 2 days of talks will be difficult.
I would be somewhat surprised if there was any real change in the negotiating stance of either party. And specifically China, they don't want to open their market, is the fundamental point.
Balding added that the current dispute is unlike any other in recent history.
This is about how disputes are settled. This is about how one country views the international system as compared to the other. This is about how one country believes an economy should be run and how they have conflicting views of those two things.
He says that the best that can be hoped for is that the two countries find enough room to compromise to not go forward with the trade war. Happening in Asia, the Pentagon says the U.S. issued a formal complaint to China over the use of lasers directed at aircraft and resulting in minor injuries to two American pilots near a military base in Djibouti. The Pentagon says reports from pilots indicate that three times the lasers were military grade and came from a Chinese base nearby. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The latest UN estimates say that nearly 1.9 billion people live in South Asia. Continued climate change could cause upheaval in that region as temperatures climb and areas become warmer and more arid. Muthukumara Mani is a lead economist at the World Bank here in Washington. He's also the author of a book entitled South Asia's Hotspots. He spoke with VOA's Skylar Ogden Thursday about how climate change will affect the standard of living, what governments are doing about it, and what people can do to adapt to new realities on the ground.
In our book, we define hotspots as regions where which will experience a declining living standards because of climate change.
I want to just take a step back looking at the macro situation. Is South Asia more vulnerable than other regions of the world?
Yes. Mainly because of its geography, because of its location, and also the fact that it's home to a large segment of the world population who are poor and who have poor coping capacity to deal with climate change.
What are some of the commonalities between these between the areas that are particularly vulnerable?
So when in the book we look at the hotspots areas, and we find that a lot of things are common across these hotspots areas. One is they all are less developed. In general, they are poorly connected to markets, and they all are water stressed. So these are some of the things that we find common across hotspots across all these countries.
How are people's living standards being impacted now?
Your living standards will be impacted depends on where you live and what you do, right? Okay. If you're a poor agricultural farmers, obviously you'll be impacted by the increasing temperature and the erratic monsoon rainfall patterns that will impact your crops, and obviously crop failure will put you in a bad shape. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you're an urban laborer, spitting it out in the open, obviously increasing temperature could lead to heat stress and so on. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you're a coastal fisherman, unusual flooding, coastal flooding may lead to decline in your fish yield. It may then force you to leave your coastal area and move inland. So, mm-hmm. So it all depends on where you live, what you do. But invariably, we find that it's the poor who are the most vulnerable because their coping capacity is poor.
Looking at the situation now, are there any governments, you know, that you think are doing a particularly good job of addressing climate change issues on the ground?
Yes, I would say that all countries, especially I can talk about South Asia, mm-hmm. I'm more familiar with South Asia, they all recognize climate change is a major challenge, and they're doing their best to deal with the situation. Mm-hmm. If you talk in terms of climate mitigation, obviously India is a major carbon emitter, but then the Indian government has ambitious plans to reduce the carbon emissions. For example, under the Paris Agreement, they promised to reduce their carbon intensity of their economy by 30-35% by 2030, mm-hmm. increase the share of electricity generation from renewable sources by 40%, increase the solar capacity by humongous 175 gigawatts. So clearly, the country recognize that it's a problem, and they're doing their bit to reduce the burden on the communities. And similarly, in terms of adaptation, countries have really scaled up their early warning system, providing information to the farmers ahead of time. They're increasing their flood protection plans. They're building embankments. Nepal may actually benefit from climate change because there are considerable parts of the country that are really cold right now. And because if the climate becomes warmer, they may actually be able to increase their agricultural area. Similarly, colder regions in India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, we find that they could actually benefit from climate change.
Muthukumara Mani, the author of South Asia's Hotspots, speaking with VOA's Skylar Ogden. Coming up, imagine not going to the movies, but being in them. This is VOA Asia.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This news from Asia, at least 78 people were killed in northern and western India when powerful dust storms knocked down power poles, uprooted trees, and destroyed homes. The district of Agra, the home of the Taj Mahal, was one of the worst hit. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. The first Saturday in May is the date of the first jewel of U.S. horse racing's Triple Crown, the Kentucky Derby. As VOA's Abby Sun tells us in a report narrated by Millar Sega, two horses partly owned by the Chinese Horse Club are among the top contenders this weekend.
It's the call to post at Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky. The signal to horse racing fans that no bets means no glory. This year, the China Horse Club is betting big on two of its thoroughbreds, Audible and Justified, considered top favorites at this year's Kentucky Derby. Architect Teo Ah King discovered a passion for horse racing after designing a racetrack in Dubai. 2 years ago, he founded the China Horse Club.
It forces me personally to understand not just the building, the regulation, and it forced me to understand about the horse and to experience why make horse owner so crazy about these type of horses.
With so much to learn, Teo partnered with Windstar Farm, one of the leading thoroughbred racing and breeding operations in Kentucky.
China Horse Club have been a wonderful partner. They're very understanding of the horse business. They have realistic expectations. You know, they understand what to expect.
But with two presumptive favorites running in Saturday's race, expectations are understandably high. Horse racing is a multi-billion dollar industry that employs tens of thousands in Kentucky. A win here by a Chinese-owned thoroughbred could open up a hot new market for Chinese investors.
Chinese are extremely entrepreneurial. They are extremely comfortable with taking financial risks in order to get a huge financial return.
For now, Teo's focus will be on what racing fans call the greatest 2 minutes in sports. Win or lose, Teo is philosophical.
There are 16 horses, there'll be only one winner. What if the horse came third, fourth, and you watch the person, how they react after the horse did not win? That is also a very good lesson to teach somebody in life.
Justify is a 3-to-1 favorite to win Saturday's 144th running of the Kentucky Derby. Teo hopes Audible, who won last month's Florida Derby, won't be too far behind. For reporter Abby Sun, Millar Sega, VOA News, Louisville, Kentucky.
This news from VOA Asia, Bollywood actress Sridevi Kapoor, who died in February, was named Best Actress at India's National Film Awards for her last role in the revenge thriller, Mom. Her husband and daughters received the prize on her behalf. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Virtual reality experiences are becoming more physical and more interactive. As Tina Trin tells us at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York, creators are pushing the boundaries of the digital and physical divide.
Virtual reality fans love the technology for its ability to transport and immerse them in new worlds. At the Tribeca Film Festival, Martina Ley and Nico Casavecchia were showing off Battle Scar, a VR film about two girls navigating the 70s punk scene in New York's Lower East Side.
The late 70s in New York, it was like a big mixture of things growing up, things dying. I mean, like disco was dying, rock was dying, punk was growing up.
For this interactive VR film entitled Firescape, the creators drew inspiration from a cinema classic.
It's sort of a neo-Hitchcock rear window, which puts you on a fire escape in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, while a crime takes place, and you have the chance to watch seven synchronous stories.
While these works showcase the potential of future cinematic experiences, other films give viewers a leading role. Hero puts you on the ground in Syria with the ability to walk within scenes and touch physical objects that correspond to what you see.
When a person realizes they can actually step around, they can actually lean on a thing, they can reach out and touch a wall, they can grab a piece of rebar, it's a powerful moment.
This, for me, is really the birth of a new format.
So says the director of Jack Part 1, a retelling of the children's fairy tale Jack and the Beanstalk. But in this version, viewers pick up props and interact with actors outfitted with motion capture markers.
One of the actresses hands them something like a stool, and you reach out and you go, wow, this is here. And you're told to sit down on this stool. You're like, wow, I can actually sit down on an object that's being represented in virtual reality.
The new format is taking VR experiences out of the living room and into new and unfamiliar environments. And it can take some getting used to.
Some people don't dare to move, to touch, or just respond. They're like, why don't you talk?
Filmmakers predict these location-based experiences will ultimately become a new way to go to the movies.
The art is ahead of the tech for once, and that's where it gets fascinating because we need to push things forward to be able to do that kind of story on a larger scale.
It's a problem filmmakers are glad to have.
It's like a dream come true for a filmmaker to be able to explore a new medium that has no defined language. This is uncharted territory, like you are really exploring something and making the boundaries as you go.
Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
The European Space Agency has released an updated catalog of more than 1.7 billion stars in our galaxy. VOA's George Putich tells us about it.
Our galaxy, the Milky Way, has about 100 billion stars, and cataloging them is a daunting task. Thanks to the European Space Agency's spacecraft Gaia, we now know the accurate position, brightness, distance, motion, color, and temperature of about 1% of them, which is still a huge number, 1.5 billion. Placed in an orbit about 1.5 million kilometers from Earth, Gaia has been scanning the universe since the end of 2013 with three different instruments.
Astrometry is measuring the positions, which helps to get the distances and also the motion of the stars. Photometry is essentially getting the color of the star, and color gives us the temperature of the star. With spectroscopy, we are using one element which is based on Doppler effect. We are looking how the lines on the spectra are moving, and we get the speed of the star on the line of sight.
Slowly rotating around itself in its circular orbit for up to 9 years, Gaia's cameras will observe each of the targets about 70 times. While collecting solar energy on one side, its 10-meter-wide solar panel also shields the instruments from the sun's heat, ensuring their thermal stability. In addition to stars, Gaia has detected tens of thousands of Jupiter-sized exoplanets scattered throughout our galaxy, tens of thousands of asteroids buzzing throughout our solar system, as well as other galaxies and quasars.
The advantage of seeing some quasars is that the reference system of coordinates is based on quasars because they are far away, so they don't move.
Astronomers around the world are already using the newly acquired data for their studies.
Essential thing of the Gaia mission is that the surprises will come later because we make the catalog and it is the scientists in the community who are going to utilize it and give the scientific surprises to us.
The Gaia mission was planned to last until the end of 2018, but scientists now say it may be extended for up to 4 years. George Putich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Be sure to get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Let us hear from you on VOA Asia Facebook. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Cornelius Wilson. I'm David Byrd. Enjoy the rest of your day.